This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Levels of arsenic in the compound. The test was commissioned by the anti-fluoridation group Clean Water Portland. In addition, the Oregon Health Authority just released the latest figures on children's dental health in Multnomah County, showing significant improvements in all categories and bringing into question the county's claim that fluoridation of water is necessary to improve dental health. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg has more on this story.
The Oregon Health Authority just released a report on dental health in the state after repeated information requests from media agencies and activists. The report usually comes out in January. This year, it was inexplicably delayed until late May. It showed across-the-board improvements in dental health for kids in Multnomah County over the last 5 years. Supporters of water fluoridation had used 2007 numbers to claim there is a dental crisis in Multnomah County. But the rates of cavities, untreated decay, and rampant tooth decay have all decreased significantly in Multnomah County kids in the 5 years following that study. In fact, average cavity rates for kids in Portland schools are now 5% less than the average cavity rates for kids around Oregon who drink fluoridated water. Kim Kaminsky represents Clean Water Portland, which opposes fluoridation of Portland's water.
And so Portland's teeth are better than cities that have fluoride in their water. And we've already met the federal 2020 goals 7 years ahead of schedule.
So why is the city promoting this idea that there is a major dental crisis in the city of Portland that needs to be dealt with through fluoridating the water?
Well, I think that that's what they've used to justify pushing this through in the way that they have. But the data that came out doesn't support that.
The Oregon Health Authority did not respond to questions on why the report was delayed and only released after multiple records requests. The authority maintains its support for water fluoridation in Multnomah County. In a separate report released today, Clean Water Portland had a sample of the fluoridation compound, hydrofluorosilicic acid from Philomath, sent to an independent lab for analysis. The lab found high levels of arsenic in the sample. Hydrofluorosilicic acid is the coal industry byproduct that has been proposed as a fluoridation agent for Portland's water. Kim Kaminsky with Clean Water Portland.
It's a byproduct of the phosphate mining manufacturing, and it's basically what they collect from the wet scrubbers of the smokestacks because they can't emit it into the air, they can't dump it in the ocean, they can't put it in the rivers. They would have to pay to dispose of it in a toxic waste facility, unless, of course, they can sell it to a municipality and put it in the water.
What's the difference between that hydrofluorosilicic acid and pharmaceutical sodium fluoride as a fluoridating agent?
Well, the hydrofluorosilicic acid, as the name implies, has silicone compounds in there. And there was a recent study comparing arsenic levels in the silicone fluoride compounds versus the sodium fluoride. And the silicone compounds had very high levels of arsenic compared to the sodium fluoride, which is what you find in your toothbrush. So it's not the pharmaceutical grade that you get. If you go to a pharmacy, you get drops or tablets, for which you need a prescription, by the way. It's not pharmaceutical grade.
And why would the city choose that over adding pharmaceutical grade sodium fluoride if they are going to fluoridate the water?
Because pharmaceutical grade is cost prohibitive.
So it costs more. Now, this planned fluoridation of the water will cost the city $5 million. Is that correct?
Well, we have internal documents that show that just the construction of the facility alone could cost up to $7.6 million. And we also know that the fluoridation chemicals are estimated to be $500,000 per year. And we also know that the city's budgeting process sometimes isn't always accurate. And the bottom line is this. When these estimates were put forth, it was expected that the water districts to whom Portland sells water would be floating part of this cost. 40% of our water is sold to outlying regions. And those regions, Tigard, Tualatin, Gresham, they're in long-term contracts with the city of Portland. And they it's no secret that they are very upset that not only were they not consulted, but their citizens can't vote on the issue and they can't elect City Hall. So if they're not going to help defray the cost, it is going to be borne by the Portland ratepayers. And the Water Bureau has essentially asked the ratepayers in the city of Portland to write them a blank check.
The pro-fluoridation group Healthy Kids, Healthy Portland responded to the report by calling it ridiculous and stating that, according to the Center for Disease Control, quality testing has found that most fluoride additive samples do not have detectable levels of arsenic. The group stated that the EPA allowable criterion for arsenic consumption in drinking water is 10 parts per billion. But according to the Environmental Protection Agency's health-based drinking water standards, there are no acceptable levels for arsenic in drinking water. The debate about fluoridation in Portland has raised emotions on both sides of the issue. According to Kim Kaminsky, the public has not had enough time to get educated on the issue, particularly as new studies continue to be released.
Well, I think that there's still a lot of room for discussion, and it's a divisive issue, and I think people deserve the time to educate themselves and to understand the issue. There's a reason why City Hall moved this election up by a year. We had over 43,000 people sign petitions to put this to a vote of the people. On those petition sheets, it said that the election would be in May 2014. The very last day of Randy Leonard's term and Sam Adams' term, they voted to move the election up by a year because they knew it would limit our ability to do education and outreach and fundraising.
Ballots for the special election will go out in the mail tomorrow and must be returned by May 21st. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
The Oregon State Legislature has passed a bill that will make it easier to construct large-scale solar facilities in eastern Oregon. The bill, HB 2820, reworks the definition of arable land in relation to solar facilities in order to make it easier for solar companies to get licenses to operate in eastern Oregon. The state has tried to be a leader in alternative energy, with wind, solar, and wave power companies investing in Oregon. However, the potential loss of federal tax credits has caused some companies to pull out of the state.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is trying to break up the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association, a union of police lieutenants, captains, and commanders that currently represents 51 people. According to the Oregon Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, so-called supervisory employees should not have union representation. Supervisory employees are those who exercise independent judgment in managerial tasks such as hiring, firing, promotion, transfer, and assigning and directing work. The city argues that these are supervisory employees, so the Commanding Officers Association should not be permitted. On Wednesday, a deputy city attorney filed a petition with the State Employment Relations Board asking for a clarification of the public employee status of commanding officers. The union has 14 days to issue an objection, at which time the matter goes before an administrative law judge. Since the union provides job security and other benefits for commanding officers, some in the police bureau worry that disallowing the union will eliminate incentives for officers to seek promotions.
After a three-year campaign, Portland security officers reached a tentative agreement today with private security contractors. A statement from their union, SEIU Local 49, says that this historic agreement moves low-wage private security officers and the industry forward on wages, health care, paid time off, and job protections. A picket planned for later this week has been called off.
Organizers with the Laborers Union Local 483 are working to unionize Portland's 15 park rangers. This is part of a larger campaign against the city's widespread use of part-time and seasonal workers to fill low-wage jobs without benefits. Portland's park rangers are armed only with pepper spray and radios and are charged with keeping the peace and enforcing rules in Portland's parks. Four of them have permanent positions paying $17 an hour with benefits. The 11 other rangers have seasonal jobs paying $11 an hour with no benefits and automatic termination after 8 months of full-time work. If unionized, the rangers say their number one priority is making all positions equal to the current permanent ones. The Rangers met with Mayor Charlie Hales after each of them signed a card stating their desire to join Local 483. Hales was supportive, but ultimately said he preferred to see city employees unionized by a secret ballot rather than a public card check. Unionizing by card check is a right of workers, but since the Rangers wish to join an existing union, the public employer can demand a secret ballot. The Rangers worry that the delay required by the ballot process will put off unionization until after the seasonal workers have been terminated.
A new bill proposed in Oregon's House of Representatives would address the accessibility of voting material to citizens who speak primary languages other than English, such as Spanish, Vietnamese, Mandarin, or Russian.
House Bill 3506, which officials speculate may affect a dozen Oregon counties, would require non-English ballot material be printed in any county where 5% of the population, or 10,000 voters, spoke a minority non-English language. It was the subject of a public hearing yesterday in Salem. Representative Joe Gallegos, the bill's chief sponsor, said the concept struck him while he was on the campaign trail last summer.
A number of the doors I knocked on, I found people who, they spoke English, but it was clear that English wasn't their first language, and it was clear that that was somewhat of a barrier in terms of their, you know, really being fully informed as to a lot of the issues, you know, that are being voted on. So that's what sort of alerted me to the concern.
Backers of the bill included Secretary of State Kate Brown, who has suggested a task force be set up to address the issue. The bill draws from the framework of existing federal law under Section 203 of the Federal Voting Rights Act, which has a similar 5% or 10,000 voter threshold for non-English voter material.
You can say it goes further than federal law in that what we're trying to do is be much more comprehensive than sort of federal regulations. The issue we're trying to address really is much more of a systemic and comprehensive approach. So as you can imagine, this goes beyond just the paper ballot that you get in the mail, but we're also, you know, the Secretary of State is also looking at website, using tablets even. We're getting into this whole media business, and that's why we need some new legislation, and particularly here in Oregon, because we're just becoming much more diverse. Demographics are changing so rapidly in our state. So we want to be able to make sure that we're, you know, including everybody and making sure that everybody has a voice and can make informed decisions.
Members of the public testified both in favor and opposition of the bill at yesterday's hearing. One critic of the bill present was John Charles, president of the Cascade Policy Institute. He called the bill unnecessary in the context of citizenship requirements.
The bill is aimed specifically at citizens who vote, and by definition, if you're a citizen under federal law, you're required to be proficient in English, so there's no need for the bill. If there is a need, then someone apparently isn't worthy of being a citizen, or at least they're not yet ready to exercise voting privileges.
Representative Gallegos responded to that criticism with a story of his own.
Again, the whole purpose of this is not to, we're not just talking about immigrants, we're not just talking about new citizens, we're talking about citizens, period. And again, as I said, trying to be as inclusive as possible. I mean, for example, my parents were American citizens, they were born in the United States, but even as adults, their English was limited, and so this kind of legislation would have helped them, certainly.
Mr. Charles's other chief concern was budgetary. In the wake of a public hearing in April in regards to an Oregon state budget that's due from the Joint Ways and Means Committee by June 30th.
At a time when the state legislature is screaming for more money, they are seriously considering a mandate to spend more money on elections. That's not necessary. And every dollar they spend doing this is a dollar not available for other more important social needs. Virtually anything. Police, fire, schools, roads, parks, assistance for housing, for food, for anything.
While Gallegos conceded it was early in the game to be speculating about cost, he provided some insight into how the issue would be handled.
I mean, I can tell you that the primary cost is probably around translation services, and we would look to that task force actually to help us to determine what would be the most cost-efficient approach to take to not only the translation services, but various forms of media.
If the bill is passed, Oregon could be joining over 20 other states that provide non-English ballot material, including regional neighbors California, Washington, Arizona, and Colorado. Despite support for Gallego's bill that he cited from 16 representatives and two senators, as well as the Secretary of State, he said the bill was likely to change along the process. For KBOO News, I'm Jen Chavez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high near 79, that's almost 80 degrees. Tomorrow night will remain clear with lows dropping to around 50 degrees.
It's 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Prostitutes are amateurs compared to Texas State Senator Kel Seliger, whose going rate is $20,000 a pop. At least, that's what he was paid last year by waste control specialists. First, some background. A decade earlier, WCS parlayed political donations to Governor Rick Perry into a special deal to build a low-level nuclear waste dump in a West Texas county, right up against the New Mexico border. Headed by Harold Simmons, a right-wing Dallas billionaire and GOP money man, waste specialists originally promised to take atomic trash from only two states. But after dumping more donations into Perry's 2010 campaign, Simmons was allowed to take trash from 36 other states. Now, back to Seliger. In exchange for taking $20,000 from WSC for his 2012 re-election race, he has dutifully rolled over to sponsor a bill in the Texas legislature this year to let Simmons ratchet up from low-level waste to highly radioactive stuff. The bill would also block residents of neighboring New Mexico from contesting this change in Texas courts. Why take this gratuitous slap at New Mexicans? Because towns there actually are closer to WSC's nuclear dump than any Texas towns. And, since radioactivity pays no heed to state borders, Sierra Club members in Eunice, New Mexico, are opposing the Texas permit. This is Jim Hightower saying, having taken Simmons' money, Seliger has been pushing hard to turn the trick for him, but even his Republican colleagues are disgusted by his shamelessness. As one put it, why would we limit affected parties to three sides of the county and not the fourth? The New Mexican neighbors, he said, are still Americans, and they should still be offered the opportunity to protest the plant's permit. Stay tuned at www.texas.sierraclub.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The Nebraska State Patrol has met with TransCanada, the company behind the planned Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, to discuss ways to deal with protesters who will inevitably target the project when it gets underway. One proposal would have off-duty police hired as security guards at construction sites. Groups like Bold Nebraska and Tar Sands Blockade stress that their actions will be disruptive but nonviolent, and decry the hiring of off-duty police by TransCanada as a conflict of interest on the state's part. Protests were able to shut down some construction sites in Texas on the southern leg of the pipeline. In other pipeline news, ads have been appearing on Washington, D.C.'s transit system depicting the ExxonMobil tar sands oil spill that devastated the small town of Mayflower, Arkansas. KBOO's Kristen Yount spoke with K.T. Reich of the group someofus.org, which is behind the ads.
So tell me about why you decided to put ads on the D.C. subway.
Sure. So we were all pretty shocked by what we saw coming out of Arkansas after the Pegasus pipeline burst and over 500,000 gallons of tar sands spilled out into an American community, coating the backyards and surrounding playgrounds. It was just jarring. And Exxon did everything it could to block access to journalists. They threatened to arrest journalists. They convinced the FAA to have a no-fly zone so that people couldn't take aerial photos. But yet, some brave activists went in and they snuck out some pictures of what they saw. And we wanted to make sure that the people who are deciding about the fate of the Keystone XL pipeline, the pipeline that's going to carry many, many times more tar sands through thousands and thousands of communities, is the people who are deciding on the fate of that know what is at stake. So we reached out to our membership, and over 2,000 people donated. And just on Monday, the ads went up in the D.C. Metro just down the street from the State Department, which are the people deciding about the Keystone XL.
What do you think is the main question that State Department workers should think about?
The environmental assessment that the State Department did was partially written by the oil, by people who are associated with the oil company that would run the Keystone XL pipeline. So the State Department has a lot of questions that they need to ask. What is the real impact that this is going to have? Is it the inevitable spills that will happen? Because it is not a question of if, but when spills will happen. How do we clean them up? Do we even know that? This tragedy that happened in Arkansas has shown that we have no idea how to clean up tar sands. It's not like regular oil. It's not, and even regular oil is very hard to clean up. So is it worth that? Is it worth trekking, funneling, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of tar sands across watersheds that you know, millions of people drink water from? Is it worth that risk? And we believe the answer is definitively no.
Obviously, there it's a fossil fuel, so we're looking at carbon CO2 release. Can you comment on that at all?
Well, I was pretty shocked when I heard the NASA scientist who said that this would be game over if we fully exploited all of the tar sands in Canada. That's pretty dire, and this is, you know, someone who, this isn't a far-left environmentalist. This guy was the top climate scientist at NASA, and he's the one who's saying this is game over for the planet. And I think that's a pretty important warning for all of us to pay attention to.
I wanted to know if there was anything that you could say about what happened in Missouri last week.
I mean, these pipelines, I don't know specifically about that one, but these pipelines are not terribly well taken care of. The Pegasus pipeline is decades old. They started pumping tar sands through it and weren't quite prepared for how corrosive it would be, and that's what led to the spill. And we're just going to see more and more and more of this the more pipelines we build. What we really need to be doing is investing in new green energy and not just trying to get the last few drops of fossil fuels out of the ground.
Why don't you, again, just say for everybody what your name is and the organization that you're working for and how they can see your website.
My name is Katie Reek, and I'm the campaign manager for someofus.org, and you can join our campaign at someofus.org/tarsandspill.
That was KBOO's Kristen Yount speaking with Katie Reek of the group SUMOFUS.org.
The state of California has filed a lawsuit against several major national food retailers for selling ginger and plum candy tainted with lead. The defendants named in the lawsuit include Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, Target, and other retailers and candy makers. California officials say that the lead content of the candy violates the state's Proposition 65, which requires labeling of any product that includes known carcinogens or dangerous chemicals, including lead. The retailers have not yet given any response to the lawsuit.
Earlier this week, the European Union voted in favor of a 2-year ban on a class of pesticides associated with bee colony collapse disorder. Today, a report by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency rejected the claim that pesticides were the sole reason. The report blamed a combination of reasons, such as viruses, bacteria, genetics, and a parasitic mite, as well as pesticides, for the massive decline of honeybees since 2006. Researchers behind the report put pesticides at the bottom of the list, saying there was no clear proof of them being a major factor in colony collapse. But Jennifer Sass, a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, said that while she agreed that multiple causes are at play, it seems an opportunity for strong action was missed. Since a certain type of pesticide is known to be part of the problem, she said that a limited ban, such as the one the EU implemented, would at least help in bee colony recovery. Sass said, quote, "The bees are in a crisis situation, and therefore so is agriculture, and so you take the action that can be taken now." The pesticides came onto the market in the 1990s, and beekeepers started reporting a perplexing collapse of honeybee populations a decade later.
Gun-toting heroes like Davy Crockett and G.I. Joe loom large in the eyes of America's youth, but how young is too young when it comes to arming children? A nationwide string of rifle shootings involving very young children this week is fueling debate over kids with guns and over how gun companies market their products to minors. Since Monday, three boys under the age of 10 have been involved in sibling-related shootings. A 7-year-old girl was shot in the leg by her 9-year-old brother yesterday evening in Auburn, Washington. She was shot with a .22 caliber rifle stored in an older brother's closet. Her injuries are not life-threatening, according to Auburn police. On Monday, a 5-year-old girl was shot and killed by her 8-year-old brother in western Alaska. The boy was playing with a Ruger .10-22 rifle he had used on a hunting trip the day before, according to state troopers. And on Tuesday, a 5-year-old boy shot and killed his 2-year-old sister in Burkesville, Kentucky, with a rifle made especially for children. The boy's parents had given him the .22 caliber child-sized cricket rifle, which is produced by Keystone Sporting Arms, based in Pennsylvania. Keystone produces two My First Rifle models of the cricket, whose mascot is an armed cartoon cricket in hunting gear. Its slogan is Quality Firearms for America's Youth, and its website features testimonials from parents who have purchased the guns for their children. At press time, the Cricket website had been taken down.
The FBI has added former Black Panther and celebrated writer Assata Shakur to its Most Wanted Terrorist list. Shakur was convicted of killing a police officer in 1977, but she has always claimed her innocence. She says that in a traffic stop on the New Jersey Turnpike, officers opened fire, shooting her twice. She says the officer was very likely killed by friendly fire from a fellow officer, but a ballistics test was never done. In 1979, she escaped from prison and fled to Cuba, where she lives openly and where she raised her daughter. Shakur wrote at the time of her escape that she did not believe that she could get justice within the U.S. justice system and felt that escape was her only option. Shakur says she felt she was left with no other choice than to flee from the political repression, the racism, the violence that dominate the U.S. government's policy towards people of color. According to the FBI, Shakur is part of a, quote, radical, left-wing, anti-government, black separatist movement. They increased the reward for her capture to $2 million.
Earlier today, the Guatemalan government declared a state of emergency in four townships after clashes between police and anti-mining protesters. Recent violence has resulted in one policeman's death, six protesters wounded by rubber bullets, and police cars burned. Other protesters captured 23 police officers, seized their firearms, then released them. The Interior Ministry banned public meetings in the four townships near a Canadian-owned silver mine and sent in hundreds of police officers and soldiers. The mine, which is not yet operational, is located in the province of San Rafael Los Flores, about 40 miles outside of Guatemala City. The local residents are mostly part of the Xinca indigenous group, who fear the mine will threaten their water supply. Mine officials say fears that the mine would affect local springs were totally unfounded. The emergency decree allows the government to conduct searches, question suspects, and make temporary detentions outside the usual legal restrictions. The Legal Action Center for Human Rights said that crime should be prosecuted, but said the community's legitimate right to oppose the mine should not be criminalized by the Guatemalan government.
In Bangladesh, 430 people are confirmed dead, with up to 900 more still missing a week after the collapse of a garment factory. The 8-story Rana Plaza building, located in the capital of Dhaka, contained 5 textile factories that produced clothing for Western brand names. The AP reports that police ordered an evacuation after noticing large cracks in the building on April 23rd. Some tenants refused to open, but the factory managers ordered their employees to work as usual. Up to 1,300 people have been registered as missing, though some of the names on the list may be duplicates. The military is dismissing the number as a rumor. Relatives of victims accuse authorities of hiding bodies to keep the official counts low. As the world celebrated International Workers' Rights Day yesterday, rescuers continued to pull bodies from the rubble and thousands took to the Bangladeshi streets to protest conditions that they say court disaster for workers in the $20 billion a year industry. The international community is also calling for stricter labor compliance regulations in Bangladesh after a string of similar incidents, including a factory fire that killed 112 people last November.
A Greek member of parliament allegedly attempted to punch the mayor of Athens and hit a 12-year-old girl instead, according to The Guardian. Georgios Germenis of the Golden Dawn Party was seen struggling with bodyguards of the mayor after police disrupted an event in which Golden Dawn members distributed free food on Easter, on the condition that it was given to Greek citizens only. The mayor of Athens blocked the event, referring to it as a, quote, soup kitchen of hate. The ultranationalist Golden Dawn Party has seen a significant rise in its popularity and is now the third most popular party in Greece as far as parliament representation. They are frequently cited in the media for their active willingness to use violence. The Golden Dawn Party issued a statement denying that the girl was hit and that they intend to sue the mayor and his security guards.
An alumnus of the University of Oregon has been sentenced to 15 years of hard labor in North Korea. Kenneth Bae, a U.S. citizen, was accused of plotting to overthrow the North Korean government, a charge which he strongly denies. The U.S. State Department has called for amnesty, but officials say they're still trying to get all the facts in the case. The Swedish embassy in North Korea, which handles consular matters for the United States, didn't